Welcome to the Omfer podcast.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Marsh. I'm the chairman of Omfer, and it's a great pleasure today to be speaking to Øystein Olsen, who up until the end of February 2022, for 11 years, was the governor of the Norges Bank, the central bank of Norway, and in that capacity did have responsibility for NBIM, Norges Bank Investment Management, which looks after the so-called pension fund of Norway, which is a sovereign fund, the biggest sovereign fund in the world, with $1.3 trillion under management. And Øystein has had a career before that as a statistician. He was the manager, director of Statistics Norway, and he's had a long role also as a government economist, looking particularly at energy. And so he's an expert in a series of fields ranging from monetary policy through to the big questions of energy security, which have become particularly preoccupying in the light of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So I'd like to speak to you about also the history of NBIM. When this was set up, people thought of this at the end of the 1960s, when Norway first became aware of its riches. The first endowment, the first money wasn't paid until about 25 years ago by the Norwegian government. You've had a lot to do over the years, Øystein, in framing this fund. Compared with your thoughts when you started it, or you and others in Norway had the idea of this fund, how do you think the fund has turned out in the light of history, bearing in mind your original expectations and ambitions?
Well, David, I'll respond to that history and your question, but let me first just say thank you for the invitation here. It's a great pleasure to be invited to London. It's a transition to go from a full position as a governor to a retirement person, but it's nice to have invitations also from an international network. And to keep to be in contact with the professional network international. So I appreciate to be here. On the history of the oil fund, which actually go back, the fund construction is just an accounting practice design. Actually, the account was established in 1990. So that was the point where the fund was established as an account formally. And the intention by the fund construction, and that's quite essential, is that there should be, and it was by law. It was a special law. It was called the Petroleum Fund at the time. And the Petroleum Fund law says that whenever there is this overall surplus on the fiscal budget, that surplus should be placed in this savings account for the government, and also by law, the money, the capital, should be invested abroad. So at the background for that construction was first a case of transparency. It was quite transparent whether the government overall, on a consolidated basis, had a surplus. That surplus occurred for the first time in 1996. That, again, I was back in my career. I was a civil servant in the Ministry of Finance. And in 1996, the first deposit was made in the petroleum fund, reflecting a similar overall surplus on the fiscal budget. So that's a very central feature of this fund. It's a accounting design. And has a main objective to make that quite transparent, and also to secure that the financial savings on the hand of the government is taking place abroad, because that's not perhaps clear for everybody, but the only way a nation can save financially is to save abroad.
But also one of the ideas was to prevent the Norwegian currency itself from becoming overvalued as a result of too much wealth being built up to be invested, say, in the domestic stock market, which wouldn't have been anyway anything like big enough, and that to avoid the so-called Dutch disease, therefore it had to invest abroad. But also, I may remind everybody that at that time the oil price was very low, wasn't it? It was something like $10.
Yeah, it was quite low, and even in those years, where I was more or less responsible, at least took part of making prognosis for what we could expect as a projected fund build-up, it wasn't close to the actual numbers that have occurred over the years. So the oil price was quite low, but during the 90s, oil prices came up and up. And when I now approach 2000, it was quite clear that the revenues that the government could expect from these activities were to become much higher than previously thought. And that actually formed the background for another important construction. It's not a law. It's not a formal guideline, but it is a fiscal rule that has governed the actual spending of these of revenues from this oil fund over the fiscal budget since that time. We call it a fiscal rule, and in simple terms, it says that whatever should be spent from this oil fund in the ordinary fiscal budget should be limited to 3% of the fund capital. That has another interesting logic, namely if, as long as the politicians stay to that rule, if they year by year spend the return, the real return, that is,
which is 3 or 4%.
Yeah, it started as 4%, now it's 3%.
Yeah.
If they follow that guideline over time, that will preserve the capital. It's like having a huge fortune in the bank, and you spend your interest rates in revenues all the time. Then you spend the interest rate revenues, but but the capital is preserved for future generations. So that's, it's not only the people who live now who could benefit from the fund. The fund is actually preserved for future generations.
Well, I want to get onto this issue of how could the fund eventually be wound down, but I want to get onto that later. If we just look at the construction of the fund as it is, as you say, it pays out in most years a certain amount, a relatively small amount. Nonetheless, because the fund is now so huge, this is something like 20% of the nation's budget, isn't it, that is paid out every year. You've also got this remarkable transparency on your website. You see every tenth of a second the amount of money that is under management. It is a huge amount. It's risen 20 or 30 fold over the last 20 years. And I believe it's right that the value of the fund is now worth more than the value of all the oil and gas under Norwegian soil. Is there any way that we can look at this fund and say this is exemplary for other funds around the world? Because people often say it's quite rare to have a sovereign fund in a democratic country, particularly with this level of transparency that you have.
Well, I think the answer is yes. We have experienced that also over the years. There has been a number of requests from other countries which have discovered oil and have been about to have surpluses from oil and or gas production to learn from our experience. The way I seek to explain it is it's a very simple, model, actually. It's actually like a private person having a big sum in the big lottery. You don't want to spend it all. If you can survive and have a good life by spending the return year by year and preserving the fund capital, your children and grandchildren, that's fine. And it's logical also, I think.
You do follow a certain set of ethical principles. You're also a fund which on the whole is an index fund. I think you call it an enhanced indexation. You've got 530 people who manage this enormous sum of money. So clearly there's not a lot of active management in this. Is there a danger that this could get used for political purposes? The politicians are in general in charge of this fund. It's under very strict controls from the government and from Parliament. Is there a danger, do you think, that there could be a political spin put on the way that the fund is performing and the way that it is invested?
It's a potential danger, but I must say, since I've been part, I've been close to the fund construction, both as a civil servant in the Ministry of Finance and also for more than 11 years as a governor and chair of the MBIM, the management organization. So I would say all credit to the politicians, which since 1995 has stick to the rule. They have been very clear that it's the financial, these are financial investments, should not be, that's been explicit in many, large number of policy documents. Then there is also a danger that this is going to move in some direction. You're right that the fund has a set of ethical guidelines. Every huge fund, sovereign wealth fund, should have that, because there are some things going around the world that the Norwegian people, which is the owner here, simply doesn't want to invest in. We have moved out of a number of weapon industries and some other areas, firms, sectors, which we don't want to participate
in. Tobacco, for example.
Tobacco. So far, that has, I think, the that danger you indicate isn't there. And my trust and confidence to politicians to separate from and abstain from using that fund more fundamentally as a political tool, I don't think that's going to happen.
But there's some kind of politics in this, even in terms of governance. For instance, yeah. You do pay a lot of attention, I do, to shareholder governance, and you've now got a much more up-to-date and also rather open set of principles regarding the way that you vote at annual meetings. And I believe also you make public 5 days before the annual meeting,
yes,
which way you're going to vote,
yes,
clearly in the interest of influencing other shareholders. Is that not politics with a small p?
Not as long as this way of actually doing investments, having responsible investments, taking into account different governance issues, judging whether these investments are sustainable in the longer run, whether they are ethical, as long as all these individual investments decisions are left to the manager, that is to in our case to MBIM, I don't think it's a problem. It's the other way around. I think all investors in our time has to pay more attention to what I just now denoted as responsible investments. First, because to be irresponsible per se, but also because there be in many cases there is a correlation between sustainability in along an ethical dimension and to have a sustainable, long-term, beneficial, profitable investment.
But if you drill down a bit more into this, you look at the fact that there's an exclusion, for example, for companies which are involved in the manufacture in any way of nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Is that really consistent with Norway as being a member of NATO, where you do actually rely on the American nuclear umbrella?
I do agree that that example and tobacco, which is not forbidden. I mean, there are still some Norwegians smoking. It's not forbidden. The production is not forbidden. There are a number of dilemmas of this kind. I do agree. Still there is consensus in the political camp not to invest in tobacco, and the government and politicians representing the people, that's the owner.
Yes,
and,
well, I think we have to accept that.
There are dilemmas, obviously.
Let me take another example. Coal. You could say that a company that is running coal-fired power stations as a transition towards renewables is actually doing a good thing, and yet you don't invest in, say, RWE, which some people believe is a transition company. Do you think that's another area of nuance where perhaps there could be a rethink?
Well, you can point at even more examples, which I would agree point to some dilemmas. Why don't we invest in coal companies? Since is oil completely different as regards, say, the climate risk than coal? It's slightly better, yes, but it's also a source to global warming, and it's a dilemma that this is an oil fund, actually based on extraction of oil and natural gas, fossil fuels. But again, my final response to this is that it's up to the politicians to decide. As long as they stick to their main strategy, namely that basically we should go for a financial return, there are some exceptions. As long as those decisions are not taken by us, as long as the exclusions are not taken by the bank, but by politicians. Yes, that the decisions made with respect to weapons, tobacco, or coal, they are political decisions. But it's free for politicians to decide on politics.
No,
for us, it's a restriction. And as long as those restrictions, in summary, are not too large, too many, it doesn't really is a problem financially.
It is true. You do have a list of the exclusions on your website, and you do own on average something like 1.4% of stock market quoted companies. So there are a lot of companies in your universe. In the oil and gas area, as you say, the original endowment, and indeed some of the continuing inflow does come from oil and gas. You do invest in some oil and gas companies, but you try to exclude those companies which are maybe too dependent on upstream production. Do you think that's working satisfactorily, or do you think that will need some sort of recalibration, would you say, in coming years?
I would be careful to to give any forecast on that. I mean, the advice to move out from some oil companies was this decision made by the government, but based on advice from the central bank, actually. And the idea was to diversify on a macro basis the economy, since we are so dependent on oil and gas extraction. The oil and gas industry is a large part of the economy. You could, on the margin, you have a diversification effect if you disinvest in oil in your portfolio, financial portfolio. So that was the idea. Not extremely important, but the logic was there. But it's up to the politicians.
It's also quite a beneficial hedge, isn't it?
It's kind of a hedge.
Economy. So could I ask you about the governance aspect regarding the appointment of your own chief executive? Inge Stingstad stepped down a couple of years ago after a very distinguished time.
Absolutely.
There was a bit of a kerfuffle, a bit of a row over not so much the appointment of his successor, but how the successor, Nicolai Tangen, would deal with his own investments. What did you learn from that episode, Øystein?
Well, I guess it's you always learn something from that kind of a process, and it was a kind of storm also in the public and also in the parliament against him at a time where Nicolai Tangen has a personal fortune. He was a main owner of Aker Capital, a hedge fund. It was clear from the start that he was leaving Aker. And it was quite clear that he's going forward for the foreseeable future, he will never engage again in Aker, and all his remaining revenues from his remaining share should not go to him personally. It should go to a foundation. So we thought we had sort of, and he was 100% dedicated to the job. That was our clear impression. I do understand the sort of critical view on his fortune, and also to his ties to Aker Capital. But we thought we had managed that in a very solid way. And I was 100% confident that his mind, his head, his Nicolai Tangen's engagement was with MBIM. But still, it ended up with our measures not being enough. So we had and Nicolai Tangen took the last step, namely selling out completely of Aker Capital. And that sort of solved the dilemma.
And he's happy with that now. He's maybe slightly less rich than he might have been, but he's happy with that compromise.
He seems very happy, and he has performed, and his way of leading fulfills 100% our expectations and the way we saw him as a candidate.
And your own successor was due in time to be Mr. Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, who's a former Prime Minister, a man you know very well. Because of the war in Ukraine, that's not come to pass. No. Could you talk about also the succession and Mr. Waldenbacher, who's now taken over?
Well, yeah, there were two very strong candidates, Jens Stoltenberg and Ida Wolden Bakke, whom I know, she was a deputy governor in my time. Very competent, very bright, very clever, very experienced central banker. But of course, a very different experience altogether compared to Jens Stoltenberg as prime minister and secretary general of NATO. And it ended up the government had two very strong candidates, quite different profiles. They ended up with choosing Mr. Stoltenberg in January. And now Mr. Stoltenberg still, given the war, and I agree with him. I talked him to the phone just after he announced his decision. It's a pit. He would have loved to be governor. He's a very competent economist in addition to his experience and background. But I agree, there are even more important jobs now these days with the Russian invasion of Ukraine than being a Norwegian central banker.
But we at Omfe are very pleased that Ms. Wolden Bakke has now got the job, because it does mean that the score in our annual gender balance index in favour of female central bank governors goes up a bit. So we're very pleased about that. Could I ask you about the implications of the war? Norway is a very big exporter of gas in particular. Could Norway be a swing exporter that could actually help, together with all kinds of other measures, could help Europe get over this extraordinarily negative dependence on Russian energy? How large hopes should we place in Norway that in coming years, Norway, a relatively small country of just 5 million people, can help Europe with this enormous strategic problem that we have at the moment?
As I stated earlier today in a round table discussion on the subject of energy security for Europe, I think the answer is yes, that we could contribute. I mean, Norway is already a major Russian share of European EU imports of natural gas is about 40%, I think. But Norway is also significant. But it's not easy. And we could potentially contribute slightly more, but we could not solve fully the very ambitious transition plan that has been presented by the EU to reduce markedly the total imports of gas already this year, and over time almost get completely out of all Russian imports, to diversify of that kind. We cannot solve that. That has to be made based mostly by reduced consumption, and also increased imports of liquefied natural gas shipped from, say, either Qatar, Asia, or the US, I guess.
But you do have
We have some feeds which could contribute on the margin.
Yes.
But that issue also touches upon a hot issue in Norway, where at least before the invasion, the political camp was divided. The Greens party and others argue for not investing further in gas and oil exploration. That kind of opinions could be affected, or will be affected, are already being affected by what's happening in Ukraine, because there are a new extreme situation has popped up. Europe needs gas. Europe needs energy of different kinds. Norway is an energy nation with the export potential both of fossil fuels, including gas, but also of hydropower and renewables.
Are you getting yourself drawn in more, do you think, into these strategic and political questions? You've just turned 70. a new phase is starting in your life. Are you going to be called upon to take all parts in strategic discussions about, say, energy security, which is now a major element in European geopolitics?
I have no plan of being of engaging myself strongly in that issue, although I'm here now. I talk openly in the podcast. If I'm asked, I could say yes to new discussions on the issue, but I'm quite far from political decisions. I'm not a member of any political party. Again, it's up to the politicians to take all these very difficult decisions in the time you are living in.
That is true, but I would have thought people of some experience, and particularly if they are neutral from a political point of view, their advice might be well thought of. Could I just ask you one final question, which is really the finality of the fund? As you said, this is like a family that's come into wealth, and they don't try to spend the capital, they try to spend the return.
Yeah.
At one stage, and maybe a bit later than we think, the world will decide it doesn't want to use fossil fuels any longer. And therefore, it could be that you will have to start drawing down on that fund. How do you conceive of this from a conceptual point of view? At what stage do you think the fund could actually come to the end of its life? And could start to terminate the fund? And in what direction would this colossal fortune flow?
As governor, several of the last speeches I had as governor are pointed to this fact, which is that the oil and gas industry is a sunset industry. The resources will be depleted. Most of the resources have been invested in this fund. If they stick to this fiscal rule and consume the return, that will preserve the fund capital. But if we get growth going in the economy, and let's hope that will happen going forward, we will have renewed growth. The fund as a share of the economy will go down. And it will go down. And it, in the very, very, very long run, it will actually approach zero. So no nation can base its future on a financial fortune. That's a dead end. So I've been advocating a gradual transition of the economy and to replace the decline in oil activities with other things, which are going, and that's going to happen.
But by this time, I think your grandchildren, you have five grandchildren, I believe, they'll be 70 or 80 years, so we have some time to go.
Yeah.
Well, this won't be the last time that we discuss these long-term issues. You did come to London also a few years ago, gave a very good lecture when you were the governor. So I'd like to say thank you very much indeed, Øystein, for entertaining us with these ideas about the Norwegian fund and whether this has got some lessons for others. I would like to leave listeners with the idea that Norway is going to play a major strategic role in Europe's energy security, and therefore we'll be looking to Norway and your politicians, the active politicians, for advice and encouragement and insight, I believe. And I good luck to you.
Thank you very much, David. Norway is a European country. We are quite close. We have these energy resources. They have to be applied and used in the best possible way. Let me thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to come here and to contribute and to have conversations with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Øystein Olsen, and thank you everybody for listening, and look forward to treating you to another round of the OMFIF podcast before too long. Thank you everybody for listening. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.